Hello,
and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. It's almost 7:30 on Saturday, so I'm a little late getting this up. I've got a number of things. I had a friend's birthday party yesterday, and then earlier today I was at an event with Nobu and David. Nobody and David Goldman, former podcast guests who are also the leaders of a thing called Choir, in which they sort of take popular songs and rearrange them for choirs. And they did something special today, which I can't quite talk about yet because it's not out, but it's coming out soon, and it was so spectacular. And I'm really looking forward to when it comes out and everyone can see it. It should be up within a couple of weeks. I do imagine. So yeah, my life's just been busy, busy, busy. And this episode, it became one of those things where I didn't expect it to go on as long as it did. I was perfectly prepared to air or have two interviews today. But my conversation with Daniel Roebuck, today's guest, went on for about 45 minutes. And so I decided that it's going to be another standalone interview. I was going to air with the Moffats as well, but holding Dave Moffat, the one who talked to me, over to next week. I'm trying to narrow it down to either one or two interviews per show. I realized that when I did my last three interview show, I guess it was Tuesday, last week, or sorry, last Friday, that it was an hour and 30 minutes, and it just became long for some people. But then again, if there's three shorter interviews, I might do that as well, so we'll see. But anyway, the guest today is Daniel Roebuck, and he's not necessarily a household name, but he's one of those sort of that guy, those guy type of actors. Bring it up in the interview. The first film I remember seeing him in was in the mid-90s, a comedy called House Arrest with Jamie Lee Curtis, Kevin Pollak, Sheila McCarthy, Jennifer Tilly, and Jennifer Love Hewitt, and I think what was her first role. It came up because we were talking about Canada, and Daniel really, really loves this country and always loves when he gets to film up here. He's been in countless other films. He's done a number of films with Rob Zombie, so he's a big, big horror fan. But the subject of his interview was actually a film called Getting Grace, which is Daniel's first as writer and director. And he also stars in the movie as well. And it's very interesting because he was actually asked to be in a role about, I guess, close to a decade ago, and then just started getting reworked and ended up becoming the writer and the director on it as well. He'd always been interested in directing. And he shot it in his hometown in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and found the lead actress from Bethlehem Catholic High School, which is the same high school he went to, and he's already going to be working on a second show there this summer called The Hail Mary. I feel, not weird, but I didn't expect, we were talking about theater, and then he asked me, you know, if I'm familiar with theater, and I mentioned that I have a degree in theater. Which is, it's not entirely true, I have an associate's, but I guess I felt a little bit strange bringing up my credentials, because the show's never been about me, and it's always been about the guests, and not that the interview became about, you know, the fact that I have a theater degree, it just came up in conversation, it was just sort of, that was it, but I don't know, I felt slightly odd about, I don't know, just having that be out there, although it's not a secret. Daniel was really, really nice, and we had a very lovely, lovely talk that, like I said, went on for about 45 minutes, over 45 minutes, about so many things. Because he just likes to talk, and he just, you could tell that he really loves movies, and he really, really, really loves his craft. So, I'm going to shut up now. And I'm going to get to the interview with Daniel Roebuck. Enjoy. Daniel Roebuck, hello, good afternoon. Thanks for being here today on the phone.
I'm so excited to be here, Dan. And again, meeting another Dan is always a pleasure. We're always the most handsome men in the room. So it's a good thing you're there and I'm here. Otherwise, one of us would have to get out of the room.
Yes, yes. And it would probably be me. I would defer to the Hollywood man in this case.
Well, that's amongst our friends. We always have the bigger name rule. That when a bigger name calls in, you go, sorry, bigger name. Yeah. You hang up. I may be the taller name. I don't think I'm the bigger name.
So I'm very intrigued by this film. I know you had done some writing and directing for television, but this is your first feature film. Why was now the right time for you to make this transition in your career?
Well, it's a great question. Honestly, I think this entire path, which is something that I was thought I'd be on a lot sooner. I think, you know, we always say God's timing is always perfect. The time came, and this was the project that was available to me at the time when it came. But in that, you know, I've been very, very, very busy. And as an actor, you know, and I've been lucky enough to work all the time, you know, keeping my family in healthy in private school, you know, didn't allow me any time really to be thinking about my own heart and the projects that I had or wanted to do. But now that everybody's older and life's different and easier, I finally had I didn't have to worry about the paycheck. And thank God, because I've been living on my wife's coattails for the year and a half that it's taken us to make this thing.
You know, this film is quite a bit different than the horror work that you previously did in a lot of the horror films that people may know you from. But that's quite a heavy genre to work in, especially from a fan perspective. What did you like about the horror part of filmmaking?
Well, you know, Dan, I'm a horror fan too. I like gothic horror. And so it's been, you know, I've had so many rebirths as an actor because, you know, I'm in like a faith rebirth. I've, you know, been in horror. I've been on TV. You know, I've been in kids' movies. So I kind of have really tried to be as much of a chameleon. Working in the horror business, especially with a guy as talented as Rob Zombie, has been like, first, mind-opening, mind-blowing how many fans there are of Rob Zombie movies, and mind-blowing about how hard, like, he works to achieve his scares and his chills. And, you know, when you I went to see Rob Zombie in concert once, and I couldn't, because I know Rob Zombie, the director. I don't, Rob Zombie, the, you know, maniac jumping around on stage, you know, wailing and screaming seems like a completely different person to me. Both are equally as entertaining, by the way. And I always like, you know, collaborating with him. But I've also, the other weird thing, if I could say, imagine for a guy like me who grew up watching horror movies and loving like Frankenstein and the Wolfman, and the modern horror movies obviously are, you know, Michael Myers and Halloween, or even Phantasm. And I've lived long enough that I loved those films as a kid, and then entered into the mythology as an adult. You know, I got to be killed by Michael Myers. I got to be, you know, speared by the silver spear in Phantasm. So imagine that when I was 14 watching Phantasm, that I could think one day I'm gonna get my same cinematic demise. You're like, you can't even conceive of it.
Well, and at that age, when you were like 14, weren't you also a professional clown at that point?
Oh yeah, I had a, you know, I've always, I think I may have ADHD, Dan. I don't, I'll be honest with you. Recently, someone asked if I, someone who taught me as a child asked if I was ever diagnosed. And I said, no, but that does certainly answer a lot of questions if that's the case. Yeah, but I, you know, so like the clown thing was the perfect, because I already had a makeup kit because I was making myself look like Frankenstein. Then I became a clown in the circus. Then I did magic shows and I did impressionist shows. But everything that I did as a child, let's say, turned into something equally as interesting as an adult. Like even, you know, I used to make myself up all the time as a monster. And then, you know, I'm in a movie and they're putting, you know, Frankenstein makeup on me, or, you know, on Grimm pig makeup or whatever. And I just love it. Or I was impressionist, right? As a child, my mom would, you know, go out of her way to like take me to see Rich Little or Frank Gorshin. And then when we were doing the late shift, you know, they said, oh, they cast Rich Little as Johnny Carson. So here I am in a movie doing an impression, essentially, of a real human being, like, but not an impression, like, yeah, I had to perform as him. And then there's the guy who was my idol as a child, you know, in the same scene with me. You just can't, I mean, it's just like everything else. You just, my life keeps turning back on itself. And I'm very blessed that everything I loved, I got to fulfill. That is a true gift for a guy like me, you know, who's just a regular guy from Pennsylvania.
You know, the late shift, if I'm correct, was one of your first leading roles. I've always remembered you as a character actor. When it came to getting Grace, were you always going to be in it?
Yeah, you know, it first came to me, Dan. A producer named Mark Rupp found this script called Bending Spoons by a very talented man named Jeff Lewis. And he sent it to me to be an actor in it. And when I read it and realized that I had a, you know, like a direct connection to the material, and that the actress that Jeff had initially written in the script was so much like my own daughter, whose name happened to be Grace, it was just all kind of a meant-to-be situation. So I immediately asked if they would consider me perhaps directing it. And that was 9 years ago. That's how long it takes to get these things really going. So it was 7 years of talking about it and rewriting it. Jeff rewrote it, I rewrote it, he rewrote it, I rewrote it. And then, you know, coming up with the story that we have. So I'd always thought, I'm very clear on everything. Confused. I think he was curious to see if I'd be interested in playing, not Bill, but maybe Ron, the spoonbender. Anyway, it probably doesn't matter. I could have never played it as well as Dana Ashbrook did. So I'm glad I took the part I took, because I would have not been as good in the role as Dana is. That was a long-winded answer to your question. But I guess from the beginning, I thought I would be in it. And I thought I would direct it. And I do a lot of theater in which I direct myself. So I've developed, I don't know if it's a talent, I don't want to use that word because that sounds self-aggrandizing, but let's say it's a skill set that I've specifically developed. So making a movie in which I'm in it was easier, but I did surround myself with a lot of very smart people who, you know, also made sure that I didn't make a fool of myself.
Directing yourself in theater is very different than directing yourself in film. How did you find that relationship with yourself to be like?
Well, I fired myself twice, Dan. I had to. I was so difficult. And I wasn't doing what the director wanted. So the director fired me, and then the producer talked me back into the movie. So, and the writer said he wouldn't do any rewrites unless I got what I wanted. So everything worked out. You know, in the theater, directing myself, I'm also directing the rest of the cast. And I will tell you that on stage, have you ever done any theater, Dan?
Yes, my degree is in theater, so...
Oh, then so you'll know exactly what I'm saying. So that's so exciting. So you know what I'm talking about. So it's what is a director when you're directing in the theater? What do you always say? Always, always, always. Pace, pace, pace. Pace, pace, pace. So in the theater, if it's me on stage and things are slowing down, I really start goosing it up. you know, and I like that I could be there. First, I like, you know, if someone forgets a line, you know, I can always talk. I don't know, actors are always so worried, you know, I try to tell them every time. We don't give them the script. We only give them a program. They don't know what the words are. Just, you know, keep talking. They'll never know. They'll never know. But I do have always enjoyed that, being able to goose the energy. Now, it's different on a film because, you know, you stop and you take it. I didn't always review everything. Sometimes I knew in my gut I was more concerned because there's a lot of physical comedy in the movie. And, you know, I wanted to make sure my body was in the right place in the frame to, you know, tell the joke the best way that I could. And so, you know, you've got a monitor and you've got people who could, you could fix it right there. But in the theater, I kind of like fixing it as we go. And all of my actors kind of got used to it. And sometimes, you know, they just meander to the wrong place. And I would just, in character, like, say, listen, let me talk to you. And I move them back to where I wanted them. Like, very, very unprofessional. But it got the job done.
From an acting perspective, how would you compare the two crafts of theater and film? I heard Ben Kingsley once say, and this quote's always stuck with me, that the camera is allergic to acting.
Oh, that's so interesting. I wish someone would have told me that 35 years ago. Jeez Louise. Dan, so look, you've got a theater degree. So people do overcomplicate the, you know, let's say the metaphor. It's as simple as this. It's the same exact skill, but your throw is much, much different. So it's acting is not really different on film. It's just softer. It's just quieter. And you're right. I mean, that is a good point. The camera, you know, if you're doing it right, the camera's going to be able to read, you know, what you're doing. But on stage, your body language has to be, you know, obviously drastically different sometimes to tell a joke. But I've noticed always in any theater that I've done, and I don't have a degree, so you might tell me that this is blatantly wrong. I see a lot of theater that's not good, and it really is. If someone would just tell the actress to stand still, it would be, you know, so much better. But some directors, like, they just wanted to keep the thing moving. But the fact is, you and I are having a conversation, and you haven't been moving around, and I haven't been moving around. So why do we think we do that in real life? You know,
yeah.
We don't have to, you know, you just want something, you want it to have verisimilitude. You don't need it to have anything other than an organic sense of its actual happening in front of you. In the movie, the feedback that we've gotten kind of consistently, which is, I don't know, maybe sometimes the sweetest feedback that I hear is people feel like they're watching real people throughout the film. Like, it's more of a documentary than a film. And I purposely used Warner's as often as I could, meaning that I didn't intercut a scene with close-ups, because sometimes I think that helps create the illusion that you're watching real people if you're just seeing them stand in the same place and interact without intercutting. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. I'm curious as to how much of the characters in Getting Grace you pulled from real life. I know you shot it in your hometown, and the funeral home was run by your high school best friend, but were there any real-life counterparts to some of the characters in the film?
No, you know, not really. Because Jeff created the characters out of whole cloth. He did, I think, Grace was based on a young lady, maybe a niece in his life, and I don't know the full story, and honestly, as she evolved, she took on a life of her own and took on more of a, you know, a similarity to my daughter. I would say that Grace is like my daughter, Grace, but has never been sick, obviously. But there are speeches in the movie that are directly pulled from real life. There's a speech you might see in the trailer. A few people go to GettingGraceTheMovie.com in the trailer, they'd see a character say, "Sometimes people get grace, others never will," which is an astounding simile. Is that the right word? You tell me, you have the degree. But that was spoken at, my ex-wife said those words about my Grace when two teachers both had the exact same kid and one loved her and one didn't. And they used the same reason for one not loving her and one loving her. But some people are open to the beauty that life holds for us and that God's presented to us, and others just want to wake up and kind of turn off the obvious beauty in the world. They want to ignore it. So my job now, I see my job now as director of this movie is to remind people of that beauty. If I was doing Chekhov, I might want to remind them that, you know, something desperately sad is happening. Getting grace, you know, it's a movie about cancer, but it's not about dying from cancer. It's about living with cancer.
Right.
And, you know, living as best you can.
The idea to set it in your hometown, I think I read that it was supposed to originally be set in Michigan, and then you're like, no, I want to set it in Bethlehem, in the Lehigh Valley.
Yeah, so that was because, so Bethlehem is, you know, it was a steel town. I think even up there, people would have heard of Bethlehem Steel. You know, it was known for one thing, and then the steel business, you know, disappeared from America, essentially, 35 years ago. And so the town could have fallen into a malaise, but instead it's been reborn as, you know, a vibrant community that businesses are coming to, that people are drawn to. It's, I think, listeners, you know, they make those lists of one of the great places to raise a family. It's got art, it's got culture, it's got hardworking people. And I'm going to tell you something, and this isn't, I'm not just saying this because of where you are, but I've been all over this country. And, you know, I live in like LA and it's not like Pennsylvania, but Pennsylvania is like Canada. You know, when you go to Canada, you can count on everyone saying hello back. And that's the same in Pennsylvania. If I say hello to someone on the streets of Los Angeles, you know, they lock the doors, they grab the pocketbooks, they, you know, they run away. They think you're up to something. You can't just be pleasant to people. So I went to a place where people are pleasant to people, and they would help me make the movie, you know, spiritually, prayerfully, physically help me make the movie, because it's a low budget movie. The fact that we're even coming out and that we'll be out on home video and on Netflix and everything, we've already won, you know, for a film this small to get this much is already a major success. If it comes out and people are drawn to it like they seem to be, you know, perhaps it's it could become a bit of an anthem for people to remind them to celebrate life, hopefully.
I think for me, I've never been to Pennsylvania. I've never been to sort of the Midwest, that part of the your country. But it strikes me that Pennsylvania is very, very scenic. How much of that surroundings and the cities in which we live can become characters in whatever stories we choose to tell?
Well, it's a great deal. Now, so you can't do that on stage, can you? Like, that's when we direct in the theater, we've got to create all that. We've got to create, you know, you could have a great set or sometimes a lack of set, which is also a, you know, a point that you might want to make. But, you know, you can't think of Jaws without thinking of Amityville, you know, which was Martha's Vineyard. But, you know, would Jaws look, feel, seem completely real if it was shot, you know, off of the coast of Santa Monica? The water's the water, nobody would know, but we do know, right? So we recognize there's some part of our human condition that allows us to recognize when something is authentic. So putting the characters in a real place and you know, saying it's Bethlehem is also, by the way, part of the allegory. But putting the characters in a real place and making that place seem like exactly what it is, it's a legitimate, solid place, and you could go to that park or you'd eat in that hot dog restaurant, you know, or go to that funeral home, I think helps the people understand that the people are real. I really do. I think the problem, like, was, you know, in movies, they use so many digital effects, and when they realized that they could tell, they put the camera where a camera couldn't be. And so they give away their, it's like a magician turning around and showing that the doves are hanging out of his coat. Like, if they would just use, like, CGI, like it was a real thing, a real camera, and a real camera position, it would make sense. But now everything, you know, you're on the bomb coming out of the plane, dropping onto the, you know, the USS Arizona, and there could never have been a camera on a bomb on a plane dropping out of USS Arizona right. back then. So it doesn't seem legitimate. So I think that all the mirrors, you start showing how the tricks work, and it's better to anchor something in a real place, and people have a real sense of its reality. And for some way, we can tell. We know the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park don't have weight. Even though they look like they have weight and they smell like they have weight, they don't have weight because it's a computer thing. But a real thing has weight. That's why actors need props, isn't it? You know, yeah. Like you, an actor's lost, and then you go, you know, hold this cigar box, and then all of a sudden they've, you know, they're alive to the person that they're playing because they're holding something real. They're not just trying to imagine who they are. Yeah. They become something.
You've in this interview, and I know, and in others you've done, you talked a lot about you know, your faith and your Catholic upbringing, and you bring it into this film. But would you say that this is a, you know, Christian faith-based movie, or is it a movie in which the characters have faith and are faithful, but isn't necessarily the main plot of the story? If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it makes complete sense. And although I am a Catholic, I would argue that I'm a Christian. We had the other day, I couldn't tell you how elated I was. We had a beautiful mother and daughter come see our movie. And she had the Muslim Student Union, it said on her shirt, and she was wearing a head covering. And they loved the movie. And I make a point of saying, my job isn't to tell you what faith to have. I'm reminding you that having faith could make your life easier. It is sad to me that Stephen Hawking died, and all he ever talked about was how there is no God. I didn't understand. Of course there's a God. There's a guy who played you, got an Academy Award. That's God. Like, you know, so we're told because we want to feel like we're the most important thing. But we are working in tandem with each other. That's the point of this. The point of this is we all need each other to move forward in our lives. None of us can do it alone. We're being told by popular culture that we must protect ourselves, and our point of view has to be heard. But our point of view is part of the song that God hears. We're all speaking and singing our tune, and it comes out beautiful. So that's why you don't want to impose a point of view on people. You want them to think about, you know, a point of view and maybe come to it through their own volition. So it's a movie about having faith. I think that it is probably rooted in a Judeo-Christian point of view, but, you know, if God is good and God has made us all, He's given us all the ability to discern His goodness, through whatever faith we recognize Him, you know, that should be a positive thing. You know, if we use God to be destructive, or if we use God to shut someone up or to harm someone, that's absolutely positively counterproductive to the whole point of this, which is clearly we work together and we move forward. We work apart, we stay where we are. We have fear, we stay where we are. We believe in life and everlasting life, we move forward.
Are there certain misconceptions about being a believer in the Hollywood context? Because, you know, a lot of these pundits will say, oh, the godless liberal elite, you know, are there certain things that we should know about what it means to be a believer in that specific world?
Well, it's difficult. You know, we live in a culture where, I mean, people, I guess, do say that, but Dan, I do believe we live in a culture where the idea of faith and God has been superseded by self-preservation. I think, look, you watch a movie, if you're a movie fan too, right? Look at the original Poseidon Adventure. What's it about? Self-sacrifice. Everybody's sacrificing themselves so that the others can move forward. Watch the new movie, Poseidon. You know what it's about? Self-preservation. I walked out of the movie, and I was blessed enough to be on the set because my brother-in-law had shot my movie, did some second unit work on that movie. Like, they spent $250 million, and the point they made was that you yourself were more important than anybody else. It was a direct opposite of the original point of the original movie and the original story. So that was, when I saw that, I was so brokenhearted. I actually had to bring my children out of the theater and say, I don't know what to tell you. Everything this movie said was a lie. You can't send someone to their death to preserve yourself. You got to figure out how to save your boat. Like, I had to have that teaching moment because the movie was so counter-human and counter-common sense. But so to be a Christian in Hollywood shouldn't be any different than being a Muslim in Hollywood or being a Scientologist in Hollywood. We should all be able to create art as we see it. And if someone chooses to hold me back because I believe in you know, redemption through acceptance of Jesus Christ, then they're holding themselves back. They're not holding me back. Their small-mindedness is an impediment to their moving forward. I will always move forward because I have something on my side greater than any liberal Hollywood elite or any whatever you want to call it. You know, I have faith.
I'm looking at your IMDb here, and I count, I think, nine films in various stages of production, from announced to post to pre to filming. How do you find time to do so many projects?
Well, I have a hard time saying no. And if it's a smaller project, because I've relied so heavily on the blessings of others to get my work made, when someone asks me to help them, I really always say yes, you know, because if my name or my minor celebrity has added value, I'll do anything people ask me to do. And then I'll also, you know, if Rob Zombie says, hey, you want to come take a hatchet? I'm like, sure, what time do you need me? I'll come over. You know, yeah, you could kill me horribly in your movie like you normally do. I actually said, by the way, to Rob Zombie, the last time I was tied to the chair in 31, and the guy was ready to hatchet me. And, you know, I said, you know, by the way, Rob, other directors, they actually let me star in movies. They don't just kill me in the first 3 minutes. So you find time because that's, you know, I was given this gift and I have to do it. It is getting a little harder now because we're going into our next film, which is called The Hail Mary. It's harder to be available for a lot of stuff because, you know, the writing and the producing really does take a huge chunk of time. And even promoting Getting Grace, you know, I love Getting Grace. And I you know, I want my child to go off to college and I want to start working on the next one.
Yeah. Now, speaking of the Hail Mary, I know a little bit about it, that it's a set in an all-boys Catholic school. Does it have a release date yet or anything?
No, we have. We're going to shoot it this summer in the Lehigh Valley. You know, I'm still putting it together, raising the financing, et cetera. You know, I have a heart, and I believe it will be made because, just like Getting Grace, it seems like everything is aligning for it to be made. And it's a different kind of story of redemption. It's more of a comedy. It's about this irascible nun who finds this character who's so miserable, and she knows he just needs a shot, and he could be redeemed. So she cons him into creating a football team for her at-risk Catholic boys' school. You know, all the teams are troubled. So she throws this guy in there, and you know, through them, he finds his redemption.
In terms of creating a story, how do you find the differences in creating a story around a teenage girl versus teenage boys?
Well, I have one of each. So I'm, you know, like, God way prepared me for this. I have one of each, I've got, it's funny, ever since I've announced the movie, every single person I know has said, I want to be your football advisor, including, by the way, my wife, Tammy, who does probably know more about football than I do. But you can't blame me. I watched the Philadelphia Eagles lose for 40 years, you know, so it's now, I'm finally in my glory. I get to fist pump, you know. So the boy story is different than the girl story, and it's a little different, too, because although our Getting Grace is about graces, the analogy is much more obvious. This new story is a buddy comedy. It's about two, you know, diametrically opposed forces, which is the nun and the guy, and how they you know, steel sharpens steel, how they, you know, it's his redemption, but she's also, you know, she needs to change too. Any movie that you make, story you tell, play you direct, isn't it all about some change? There's some change. You want things to change. Now maybe, you know, there's playwrights like Sam Shepard who want to shine a light that things don't change. You know, I like things to change. I like stories to move forward. And I certainly do like, I'm always depressed when a movie doesn't pay off itself. And it's sometimes hard, you know. I was doing this, I did this Criminal Minds episode, and I played a horrible, like, you know, child kidnapping, you know, molester. I mean, just terrible. But they gave me the part, you know. They just said, you want to be on Criminal Minds? And I was like, oh God, I must be a very good actor. And so I read it and I thought, oh my God, what would they have thought of me for this? Anyway, the long story is, we're doing a scene in which, you know, while I was doing it, the director came in and she was like, I was making the character too sentimental. I was trying to give him a different kind of payoff. And then, you know, I finally said, oh wait, you want me to earn the bullet, because that's what was coming for me. I had an angry mom was going to put one in my chest in about, you know, 3 minutes after the scene. So, you know, I was playing it wrong, and the director came in and, you know, altered it, because I was trying to give it a wrap-up that was different than the wrap-up that the audience wanted to see.
Right.
The audience wanted to see me go, clearly. And I deserve to. I just like in movies, you know, that's like the little Chris Nolan thing that he does, you know, he keeps the coin in Inception spinning. Well, I just spent 3 hours and I wanted a definitive answer at the end of my movie. I wanted to know what the heck it was about. So I don't like spinning coins. I don't like, oh, is Batman good or bad or whatever that stuff is. I want definitive yes or no. Good or bad, move on.
And I know with Getting Grace, you actually cast the lead, Madeline, from the local high school there. Why was it important for you to cast local?
Well, Madeline Dundon actually went to my same high school. I threw down the gauntlet that I was going to try to find the lead actress in the Lehigh Valley. I did that because I felt that would kind of, you know, prove my commitment of how important I thought the Valley was. And, you know, my friend in Hollywood said, you're an idiot. You will never find that actress there. Well, here's what I think, Dan. I was there, you know, like somebody could have found me there. I came to Hollywood and got found pretty soon afterwards, but I was there. So why couldn't there be more of me? Well, not only was, did I find this, I mean, you know, this kid's like acting at a level that, you know, I don't know that I could have found at her age. She's profoundly entertaining and extremely talented. And, you know, it was important for the city. And I did prove a point that you could do this, and it's not obvious. Because the local actors are working against Dwayne Whitaker, you know, it's from Pulp Fiction and March of Deadliners and all the Ed Burns movies, and, you know, me, who would have no excuse for being rotten. Like, and you can't tell who the real actors are and who the local actors are. Just, you know, and that goes back to, I direct a lot of theater where I worked with people who are amateurs and just kind of slowed them down and stood them still, and they became actors. It's the only difference.
And I've heard...
And you, when you direct, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
I direct with my eyes closed sometimes. It's a little different. I can't do that in making a movie because I got to look at the scene. But I'm more concerned with how they're saying it than where they're standing in the theater.
You know, I do that sometimes with my actors in theater. If they have a monologue, I'll close my eyes and just envision it.
Yeah. Yeah, because they don't, yeah, if it's you want to see what they're saying, yeah.
I've heard rumblings too that after the Hail Mary, you're already sort of have a third film in mind that's going to be set in the 1950s.
Yeah, because I have this, you know, if I keep mining the Lehigh Valley for the talent there and for the locations there, I'm a lucky man, because Lehigh Valley, there's parts of it that, you know, all you would have to do is redress some storefronts and you would be able to sell it at the 1950s. You know, and that's got nothing to do with the fact that, you know, the buildings in some of these small towns are just so old. And, you know, there's never been a sense of knocking the buildings down because they're good, solid buildings. So, I'm very excited about the third movie. I'm being a bit cagey about the title because I haven't written a third movie yet. But, it would be like a coming-of-age story for a young boy also a buddy comedy. But I'm very excited about it. I see, you know, so many possibilities in my wife Tammy will laugh, you know, I'll come out of the shower and I said, okay, it's a movie called, and it's about, and there's, and I, we all do that probably, but I developed, honed a skill where I can kind of work out all the act beats and the, you know, the climax and the denouement. It's like, you know, I can figure it out somewhere between, you know, putting on my scalp treatment because I'm losing my hair and cleaning my toes. I can come up with a whole movie.
And you mentioned just before we started that you love Toronto and you're a big fan of Canada. What do you have a favorite Canadian movie that you remember watching?
You know, I remember watching a movie a few years ago at the Toronto Film Festival that Cole Hauser was in. And, you know, it's terrible. At this moment, I can't think of what it was. But his dad, Wings, played his father. And Cole's a terrific actor. It's a beautiful story. I wish that I could. I'm embarrassed that I can't pull it off the top of my head. But I'll tell you, the Canadian movie that almost all Americans have seen more than any other is when the Canadian Transportation Department wanted to do a film about the Inter-Canadian Railroad. And they put Buster Keaton on a rail car and threw him across Canada. Every single American has seen that on public TV. And hey, look it up. If you don't know what I'm talking about?
What's it called?
It's called The Rail Rotter.
Rail Rotter, okay.
Starring Buster Keaton, probably 1964, 65. And perhaps they finished the Inter-Canadian Railroad, or perhaps they wanted to remind people about how beautiful the country was. But it is probably the most watched Canadian production in America. You know, if you had to count how many times it was watched. We do a TV show, I do out of Brooklyn, called Classic, in which we show classic movies and TV shows and discuss them from a faith point of view. And I do, like, we shoot 50, 60 episodes in a year, and we shoot them all in a few weeks. And I know Lumiano, the programmer, whenever he's 15 minutes shy, he throws in The Rail Rotter because we're both such huge Buster Keaton. I'm definitely a Buster Keaton fan. My son's name is Buster.
I believe.
And when you meet my son. And, yes.
Oh, I was just saying, I believe that the Cole Hauser movie you're thinking of is called The Stone Angel.
Yeah. Yes. Was that about 8, 10 years ago?
Yeah, it was. Well, it was 2007. Cole, Wings, Hauser, Ellen Page, Kevin Zegers, Ellen Burstyn.
Yes. Terrific.
Yes, great film, and by one of Canada's finest writers too, Margaret Lawrence.
Do you know who I love? My favorite Canadian performer is. Oh my gosh, this isn't as terrible. Like I'm having a. The great Canadian folk singer who passed away in the 80s in a plane crash.
Stan Rogers.
And Stan Rogers. Like, I know his name like I know any other name. Do you know Stan Rogers' work?
Yes. I mean, he died a little before my time, but, you know, I have a dad that's, you know, was a folkie, so I'm very much attuned to that world as well.
I would love to one day try to make a movie about that great, you know, that great song about the ship going down. It's funny. I'm having a senior moment. It's just been a long day. You know, we've been touring, getting grace around the country, and we've gone from American city to American city. And last night we left Atlanta in the middle of the night to get to Nashville, Tennessee early enough to be on TV. So there wasn't a lot of sleep. But yeah, I'm a huge fan of Stan Rogers. I listen to his music constantly, and I think he is a Canadian legend who should be rediscovered by every generation.
There's a lot of great Canadian folkers. There's Stan Rogers, Stompin' Tom Connors. As a filmmaker, how much does music play a role in crafting your story?
Well, extraordinarily, it's important. And, you know, we always talk, we talk about how I cast the actors out of the Lehigh Valley. I've got to send you a copy of our CD. We also pulled all of our music out of the Lehigh Valley, except for one performer who was from North Carolina. But I met him in the Lehigh Valley. He was touring, and we bumped into each other in a hotel lobby at 1 o'clock in the morning. And he handed me a CD, and I sent it to Tammy, my wife. I said, I know this CD is going to have something for the movie. And we found our closing credit song on that CD and then got our opening credit song from his previous one. And then all the other music was born in the valley. And even the composer of the movie, know this, Dan, tell every actor you work with, they remind them that they better stay in good stead with their moms. No one will ever have a better agent than their mom. No one. And the composer, Alex Kovacs, got a call from his mom, and she said, hey, Danny Roebuck's making a movie in the Lehigh Valley. You should see if you can put your music in it, because he's a composer in L.A. So we met, and I mean, his music's amazing. So even the score was born in the Lehigh Valley. I'll get your information, because I want to send you one of these.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Have you ever experienced making a film up here in our lovely but sometimes cold country?
Oh, constantly. Yeah. I've made, the one we made in Halifax, it took place on the USS Iowa in the Caribbean. So we shot between Thanksgiving and Christmas. That would have been the year 2000. And I can tell you that when they would take our coats from us, you know, you would have such anxiety knowing it was coming, because we had to act like it was 80 degrees out. You'd have such anxiety about how cold it was going to be. But then I realized, you know, they were taking the extras' coats, and then they were taking our coats. And so I made them start switching the order, taking our coats first and then taking the extras' coats, because it was absurd that we were all standing there literally on the bay freezing, pretending it was 80 degrees out when it was probably minus 5. And it was a great thing. My friend Colleen, who I met there, she was our makeup artist, hairstylist. I went to her dad's party, like she lived there, and the dad had all these pictures of Stan Rogers on his wall. I was like, hey, how do you know Stan Rogers? Colleen, I think, had a different name. Her dad had a TV show for years in Canada, Dennis, and he and Stan were really great friends. On one of the Stan Rogers videos where they're singing a song that's on Dennis's show, if people go to YouTube, it's they're together. Sorry about this noise here. There's a lot of shenanigans going on here in Nashville. It's evidently they call it the music capital of the world. It's evidently also the prank capital of the world. Maybe everyone's hitting the green beer a day early. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're hearing it.
Speaking of Canada quickly, I know you got to go, but one of the first films I actually remember you from, you worked with one of Canada's finest, Sheila, well, she, I don't know if you guys shared any screen time, but it was Sheila McCarthy. The film was House Arrest.
Yeah, House Arrest. Yeah, well, they were in the basement. We were outside. She's a lovely, what a beautiful, beautiful woman. So lovely. Yeah, she's definitely a national treasure. I mean, it's funny, you know, you always hear, you know, famous Canadian, William Shatner. You know, come on, that was 1964. There's been 10 million since then, you know, including, you know, of course, John Candy, Dan Aykroyd, everybody. I just think you guys are terrific up there. I happily, when they tell me I go to Canada, I happily go to Canada. And I remember, you know, there was like an anti-Canada rally, but, you know, they were people in the United States were bemoaning the fact that there was runaway production. And I got this call where they wanted me to come to a rally on a Sunday. And I was like, yeah, you want me to come to a rally? What time? Yeah, I'm actually going to be on the Alaskan flight up to Vancouver at that time, going to shoot in Canada. I like Canada so much, I actually proposed to my wife at Capilano outside of Vancouver.
Yes, I went to university there.
Oh, you did? Yeah, we went to the... I didn't do it on the bridge because there's too many people on the bridge. I took her off to the side at one of those, you know, those overlooks that go down to infinity, and I put my hand just above her center of gravity, and I asked her to marry me, and I was ready to make a decision, and she said no. I would have just... One shot, nobody would have known. luckily, she said yes.
Yeah, no, it's...
But that's really how much I love Canada. Like, I chose to do that, you know, what most of us consider a sacred act in a place that I love so much.
Well, thank you. You've been more than generous with your time. I should let you go. But the film is Getting Grace, and I think it comes out next week, does it?
Yeah, we open in America March 23rd. I wish I could say the Canadian release date is, but as I understand it, it'll seep up there sooner than later, I hope. And then we'll be on home video, Netflix, everything in July. But I'm going to try to get Getting Grace up there to my friends in Toronto and Cookstown and Barrie. I'm going to try to get it up there sooner than later.
Well, we look forward to it, and we also look forward to whenever Hail Mary sees the light of day as well.
All right. Hey, God bless you, Dan. Thank you for helping me, and good luck in the theater. I hope you break a leg time and time again.
All right, Daniel Roebuck, thanks so much. Have a good time in Nashville.
All right. All right, thanks. All right,
cheers.
Bye-bye.
So there you have it. There was me with Daniel Roebuck. The film Getting Grace comes out in the States next week on March the 23rd. It'll be on other streaming platforms soon. Doesn't know if it's going to see a wide theatrical release in Canada. He's hoping, but he's still working on it. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. You can find me on Facebook, at Endeavors Radio, Twitter, Instagram, and you can donate to the Patreon page, too, at patreon.com/endeavors. I'll see you next week. Thanks for tuning in. Bye for now.